Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Charu Agarwal, MD, MPH, a medical oncologist at Abramson Cancer Center and the Leslie M. Heisler Associate Professor for Lung Cancer Excellence at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and David R. Gandera, MD, Director of the Thoracic Oncology Program, Professor and Senior Advisor to the Director of the University of California Davis Comprehensive Cancer Center, as well as a 2017 Giant of Cancer Care in Lung Cancer, to discuss the role of liquid biopsy in lung cancer. In our exclusive interview, Agarwal and Gandera discussed the evolution of liquid biopsy in lung cancer, explained the clinical implications of recent liquid biopsy approvals, and forecasted the future of liquid biopsy in the field.
So hi, everyone. I'm Charu Agarwal. I'm the Leslie Heisler Associate Professor for Lung Cancer Excellence at the University of Pennsylvania's Abramson Cancer Center. I'm pleased to be here with Dr. David Gandera. David?
Hi, David Gandera here from the University of California, Davis. We have a hot topic today where there are data evolving basically every month. So, Charles, I'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, so David, it's our role for liquid biopsy or, you know, your plasma-based gene sequencing has increased significantly. It's becoming even more important every day with especially new approvals coming in. You know, 2020 has been a historic, I think, landmark year for FDA approvals for targeted therapy for non-small cell lung cancer, which just underscores the importance of molecular testing. And I find that plasma-based testing offers us such a nice, you know, minimally invasive tool to be able to look for these mutations in our patients that otherwise we may have missed. What are your thoughts about the evolving role of liquid biopsy?
Well, I agree with you. I think there's a tremendous potential for liquid biopsy, and we're beginning to see clinical trial results, retrospective studies, some prospective data, which suggests that we're moving into several new areas of clinical application. And I think for much of what we'll talk about today for liquid biopsy, we're not talking about single gene analysis where we started. For instance, looking for a T790M resistance mutation in a patient with an EGFR mutated lung cancer. But we're talking about primarily what are called comprehensive genomic profiling platforms that use next generation sequencing. So my comments will relate to that. Already, this sort of platform has supplanted single gene testing in almost every situation. You know, we started with liquid biopsy. Actually, our first paper was 14 years ago on detection of KRAS in blood using PCR. But now with next generation sequencing, we've moved beyond, you know, resistance situations where we want to know the mechanism of resistance to first line. And this actually has been outlined, I think, updated in a paper that Dr. Agarwal is first author on, just published in Nature Reviews. We moved beyond that also to a potential for detection of minimal residual disease and monitoring. So there's a wealth of situations here, especially in non-small cell lung cancer because of the genomic complexity, where I predict that this sort of platform, liquid biopsy, next generation sequencing, more and more is going to become the standard of care. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very important to point out that we are talking about liquid biopsy in the realm of plasma-based NGS sequencing. So very important. And David, I get asked this question often of how I'm using plasma-based testing and what are the advantages of using it, you know, against tissue-based sequencing. And my answer usually has been that tissue-based sequencing is very important. We've already established that for patients with metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer that are going to receive standard of care therapy or even clinical trials, we must establish molecular testing. We now have 7 biomarkers and 8 if you include PD-L1 testing that are absolutely recommended by the NCCN to be included. This comes shortly on the heels of approval of drugs such as capmatinib for MET exon 14. And now we have not one, but 2 drugs for RET fusion. Having said that, you know, tissue testing is important. Any kind of molecular testing is important. But what we have reported and others have corroborated is that tissue testing is not uniform. There are extreme variabilities. You know, there are tissue samples that are appropriate and adequate for tissue testing, and then there are tissue samples that are QNS, or you know, they have DNA that's degraded, or they're necrotic tumor samples. And what we showed was that if we were to layer in plasma testing with the intent of capturing the most number of patients that may be candidates for targeted therapy, that we actually do our patients a benefit by adding in plasma-based testing to tissue testing because of those reasons that I discussed. That is, tissue testing may not be absolutely possible all the time. So I do think that this concurrent approach for both plasma and tissue testing is something that is very relevant. And, you know, we discussed this in our perspectives paper in Nature Clinical Reviews, which of course you're the senior author on, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. But again, I think there are other studies that have also corroborated that even in a community setting, if we were to use a commercially based plasma NGS sample in association with whatever send out test or whatever in-house tissue test they're doing, our ability to detect mutations increases significantly. And then there's also the question for turnaround time and, you know, the rapidity with which we get results back, which we can talk about, but also this whole question of, you know, what to do with a negative liquid biopsy test. And I think we'll talk a little bit about limitations of plasma testing, but do you agree in principle that there are benefits of plasma testing above and beyond just what we get with tissue?
I do. We will always need tissue confirmation of a diagnosis of cancer. And right now, I think we're both talking really about non-small cell lung cancer. So we'll always need that. But beyond that, about 30% in studies that have been done, about 30% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer have either an inadequate specimen because it's been taken by fine needle aspiration and the tissue has been exhausted by immunohistochemistry defining this, let's say, as an adenocarcinoma. And maybe PD-L1 immunohistochemistry has also been done. And then there's not enough tissue left for subsequent molecular testing by whatever platform you would use. So that will always be a limitation. We've come a long way. Maybe 7 to 10 years ago, we were almost always doing fine needle aspirations in patients with advanced stage non-small cell lung cancer, because really you just needed to say, is this squamous cell lung cancer or is it non-squamous? But now, of course, that's very different. And in patients who, even if they have tissue available, sometimes I'll start with liquid biopsy, do a next generation sequencing platform, just because of what you mentioned, which is the turnaround time. Because no matter how you slice it, you usually are going to get the information back more rapidly. And at least the test that I use, it's 7 to 10 days for 2 different platforms. There also is an issue about tissue heterogeneity. And there is some debate in lung cancer about how often that occurs up front versus in the acquired resistance setting, let's say from an oncogene-driven cancer where it's very common. But nevertheless, if you miss something, and your studies have confirmed this, if you don't see something on tissue and you see it on liquid biopsy, it is almost always real. In other words, it is not a false positive. So I'm in concurrence with you.
And, you know, there are shortcomings, as in life, there are shortcomings with everything, right? Nothing is perfect. Can you talk about some of the shortcomings with liquid biopsy and what have you found in your practice?
Well, I think the biggest shortcoming, and this is no fault of the test, is that there will be a certain percentage of patients that do not shed very much tumor DNA into their blood. And we typically call these non-shedders. Not sure if that's a good thing to call a patient, but anyway, these people who don't shed much DNA, it may be below the level of detection. So when you get back a liquid biopsy next generation sequencing test and it says, we didn't find anything, you know, it is possible, but unlikely that's accurate. It's more likely that this is below the level of detection, and that's when you would reflex to a tissue biopsy. You know, other than that, especially early on, all the platforms of liquid biopsy, next generation sequencing, picked up some mutations, usually at very low, what we call VAF, the allele frequency, that were related to white blood cells. And this is called clonal hematopoiesis. There have been tremendous advances in the last 2 years about how you prepare the specimen to avoid white blood cells, how you detect these clonal hematopoiesis mutations and identify them as that, so they're not confounding the interpretation. But still, that remains some degree of concern. Personally, patients I've had and the studies that I've seen recently, I think this is minimized compared to what it was in the past. What are your thoughts on this or other shortcomings of liquid biopsy compared to tissue?
I completely agree. I think one of the main issues that I educate people on and my colleagues on all the time is that a negative plasma test, or, you know, a plasma test that has no detectable DNA, doesn't mean that it's negative. You know, those are the cases where they may just not have enough circulating tumor DNA because of, you know, just intrathoracic disease, or they just may not have enough shedding, as you pointed out. And I think these are the patients that should be reflexed to tissue testing. We shouldn't just take a negative liquid biopsy on face value and move on, because in addition to showing that there were patients that we could capture by plasma testing, we also showed, albeit small, subset of patients where we didn't detect mutations in plasma, but we were able to capture them in tissue. And these were most of the time patients that had M1A disease and did not have visceral metastases or bony metastases. And, you know, I think for a large number of patients that are never smokers, at least in my practice, I'm finding that they present with, you know, pleural effusions as their main site of metastases or intracranial metastases, and they don't have a large burden of disease. So I think just to drive home the point that this is not the end all and be all, I think we are moving in the right direction. A lot of companies and a lot of research assays are looking at further lowering the level of detection. And I think we'll get there where we'll be able to detect even less volume of circulating tumor DNA, but we're just not there yet. And we should recognize this.
You mentioned bone metastases. And when we were talking about one of the advantages of liquid biopsy over tissue, we do have patients where the only sites of potential biopsy are in bone. And that always creates a problem because the molecular analyses on those specimens, if they are decalcified, which is standard, will distort the molecular testing. If there's a soft tissue component to that bone metastasis, sometimes you could put a needle into that soft tissue and avoid the problem. But it just reflects the fact that that same patient, you could get an accurate molecular characterization by liquid, because that's a global assessment of that tumor genomics rather than a local assessment by biopsy.
I agree. And I think one of the things that you pointed out was the issue of CHIP also, right? I mean, I've seen JAK mutations show up in plasma that have nothing to do with their lung cancer, but we unearthed, you know, a myeloproliferative neoplasm, which was clearly related to the white blood cell component. So I think it's interesting to evaluate these results, but we must do this with a very clear lens and not just take these at face value. Really think about these reports critically.
I'll just give you a quick analogy. I was on a panel the other day with a pathologist, and she said, well, this clonal hematopoiesis is really a big problem because that patient may have a myelodysplastic syndrome in addition to their lung cancer, and you're confusing the mutations from that myelodysplastic. I said, well, you know, as a clinician, if a patient has enough of a myelodysplastic syndrome, you know, that they would be part of this issue about interpretation, the oncologist or hematologist is going to know that. They're going to have cytopenias, they're going to have abnormal erythrocytes, nucleated erythrocytes in their blood, and other things that define that problem. So again, I think although you can mention these other interference things, they're really rare. It would be extraordinary for us to confuse that particular situation. I'd like to ask you one other question, Dr. Agarwal, and that's about, so far we've kind of talked about tissue or liquid. So in the best of both worlds, and if insurance would reimburse it, do you think we should be getting both tissue and liquid because they're additive? In other words, what are your thoughts, again, in an optimal world about using both tests?
Great question. I think as our targetable mutations are increasing, I think it's becoming even more important for us to consider both tissue and liquid, and I'll tell you why. I think the panels are improving, but our panels right now in the current state that they exist are not complete. For example, some of the panels may not include all versions of NTRK, or some panels may not include, and I'm talking about various plasma panels that are out on the market, not all of them are FDA approved, but some panels may only include a handful of genes and are being touted as plasma NGS panels. These are smaller panels that often include 30 to 35 genes, and they may or may not include everything that we need to test. Also, it's important that tissue testing at various institutions as well as at bigger research assays can include both DNA as well as RNA testing. And I think RNA testing is very important in the current day and age when we have to look for fusions. I'll give you an example. I have a patient who had a solid tumor panel that was reported as MET copy number gain. And, you know, this was not a MET exon 14 mutation. And I went back to my molecular pathologist and I said, listen, what does this mean? Can you quantify this for me? How many copies are we talking about? And she said, sure, we'll just have to reflex it to a FISH panel just to give you the exact copy number gain. So I think this is the kind of information that is important to obtain when we do two different tests. And I think there are lots of nuances that are coming in lung cancer world with regards to each specific mutation. So I'm a big proponent of combination testing, wondering what you think.
I think if it was financially possible to do it, then I would do it in every patient because I do think they're complementary. And some studies have shown, you know, the additivity like your own and those of the Nile study from Natasha Liel. So I do sometimes do both, and it's just what happens in the practicality of taking care of a patient about needing to get that information. Because if it's all negative and you don't find something that really is an actionable oncogene, then you're going to probably offer that patient immunotherapy or chemotherapy together with immunotherapy. On the other hand, if you do that, and then a month later you find out that patient really has an EGFR mutated lung cancer, you may have actually done a disservice to the patient. There are data emerging, which I think is true because we've seen many cases like this, where if a patient gets immunotherapy firsthand and then a month later you get the mutation back, they're EGFR mutated, and you switch to an EGFR TKI or to an ALK TKI, that somehow the responsiveness of that tumor is blunted. you know, we've just seen several patients where their best response for both EGFR and ALK is progressive disease. And again, you know that that's just not what we would expect.
Yeah, and I think toxicity should not be underplayed. I have several patients actually who have experienced toxicities, as was reported in the retrospective review out of Memorial Sloan Kettering by Dr. Schoenfeld, you know, that showed that these patients have higher IRAEs, and I've had patients have, you know, hepatitis and, you know, grade 3 and 4 elevations of their LFTs. I've had patients with pneumonitis. And, you know, it's really troublesome to see that these patients who would have otherwise, you know, been fine with TKIs are now experiencing so many enhanced toxicities and are not able to get the right therapy. So I think you make a very important point that we should get the right therapy started first. You know, or at least the right therapy as defined by the appropriate targeted therapy if a targetable alteration is found.
Well, this podcast is particularly timely. When we scheduled it, we didn't even know about one of these, but just within the last month or so, two of these comprehensive genomic profiling next generation sequencing assays have been FDA approved in the liquid space. First, the Guardant 360 companion diagnostic, and then even more recently, the Foundation liquid biopsy CDX. This is exciting because, you know, getting an FDA approval is advantageous for many reasons. So what are your thoughts, Dr. Agarwal, on these recent approvals, realizing that these versions are not the versions people dealt with 2 or 3 or 4 years ago? And how do you think this is going to move the field forward?
I'm just very excited to have the FDA approvals for these two individual assays that have this companion diagnostic indication. And I think the assays are different in terms of what they test for and what they deliver. I think the Foundation One assay gives us TMB in addition to giving us the genes as well as the MSI score, which the Guardant assay gives us. These assays are consistently improving and constantly, you know, getting us better versions that include more genes. I think having the FDA approval signals to payers, I think most importantly, that these are relevant tests. Secondly, you know, all of the targeted therapies, whenever they're FDA approved, sort of carry that label that if this gene is detected by an FDA approved diagnostic, you know, so sort of having these two tests be FDA approved then makes us or legitimizes the delivery of targeted therapy. And also, I think, gives us confidence that we are looking at credible reports that have been approved and there's assurance by a national regulatory agency. So I'm very excited that these two assays are now available. And I think this is such a nice signal and really tells us about the momentum of the implementation of these assays in our field.
I think also my recollection is that both of these are independent of the line of therapy. In other words, that this FDA approval means you could use this liquid biopsy at the time of diagnosis to determine first-line therapy or subsequently. Is that your recollection as well?
I think they're agnostic. You're correct.
The other thing I think about the FDA approval and moving forward and liquid biopsy is it allows us to use now an FDA approved test prospectively, for example, for eligibility of patients in the clinical trials. I think that's an asset. One other thing is you mentioned that the Foundation liquid biopsy approval includes blood TMB. And of course, TMB is still controversial in some regards, although there is an FDA approval for TMB, tumor mutational burden, in tissue as well recently. But the other approved assay, the Guardant 360, will fairly shortly be converted into what's called Guardant Omni, which does include a blood TMB. It's the one that was reported out, for example, for the Mystic trial. So regardless of what you think about as TMB standard of care or not, when you order one of these tests, you will get it and you can decide what to do with it.
Absolutely. And we are very familiar with the Guardant Omni assay. In fact, you know, we are looking forward to that day when we order a Guardant test and we get the TMB in with it. I mean, I think I'm preaching to the choir when I'm talking to you, but we use the Guardant Omni assay to look at outcomes of patients that had received either immunotherapy as monotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy. And I think we did see differences where, you know, high plasma TMB patients tended to do better with even chemoimmunotherapy, albeit in a small subset of patients. So I do think that in the future, we will be using TMB, maybe not alone, maybe in combination with other factors. In our paper, we had showed that if you combine plasma TMB with other mutations such as STK11 and P10, as well as, you know, or B2, that you can actually come up with perhaps like a score or, you know, a smart TMB almost that tells you or can select patients that are not the best candidates for immunotherapy. So I do think that in the future, we will be using these biomarkers in a more intelligent fashion. What do you think, David? I mean, you've done a lot of work with blood TMB using the Foundation One assay.
Well, I agree with you completely. And I think that probably the best example of this is the two most common tests we have that are used for selection of patients for checkpoint immunotherapy. It's PD-L1 done by immunohistochemistry, and then TMB, whether it's in tissue or in blood. Almost every study that's ever been done, if you put those two together in a combination predictor, the patients who are high always do better. And the patients that are low do very poorly. And this has been borne out in a number of trials. Now, there are some differences about if chemotherapy is thrown in, does this dilute out some of the predictive value? And it probably does. But nevertheless, having those two tests, I think, helps to guide me in determining what to do with my patients. And I think we'll refine TMB as we go along.
So we've talked a lot about the current FDA approvals and the integration of plasma and GS into our clinical workflow. But David, could you comment on some of the ongoing clinical trials utilizing liquid biopsy that you think are particularly exciting?
Well, thanks for that question, Charo. I think that's been the concern among some people is, although the retrospective studies have been quite impressive, and I'll just give an example of that, the FLORA trial, where liquid biopsy using the Guardant 360 at the time of acquired resistance in that EGFR trial was quite informative. And the interesting thing is what turned up at the time of acquired resistance, as you might expect, was quite different, whether it was in the osimertinib arm or whether it was in the gefitinib or erlotinib arm. So I think that confirmed our impressions, but being able to see, you know, the percentages of patients that had secondary mutations or the percentages of patients that had MET amplification and so forth is very revealing. And that has already affected my practice. We are trying to look for MET amplification in all our patients with oncogene-driven cancers. And we've successfully treated several patients where, let's say, they started with EGFR alone, and then at the time of acquired resistance, maybe they don't have a secondary mutation on osimertinib like C797, but instead they have MET. Or some of these patients may have RET or BRAF or a whole host of things. So that's retrospective. In terms of prospective, I think there are some trials that are going to be very informative. And one of these that I'm involved in, you may be as well, is called BFAST. So this incorporates the blood TMB assay that I helped develop, but it's a umbrella trial that has a number of cohorts for ALK and MET exon 14 and RET and so forth. And it only uses liquid biopsy. And this one is by the Foundation Liquid Biopsy. And some of the data have been presented. In particular, one of the oncogene cohorts for ALK was presented, I think, at ESMO last year. And what it showed is that the prevalence of ALK was exactly what you would expect for tissue. The subtypes of the ALK translocations were exactly what you would expect. And then the clinical outcomes were exactly what you would expect in this case, giving the drug alectinib. And then preliminary data were reported on the randomization of patients to atezolizumab or platinum chemotherapy based on high blood TMB. And again, all prospective, just using blood. And the B first, which was the proof of principle, again, in my opinion, was quite impressive that this could show patients with high response rates compared to chemotherapy if you use blood TMB. So the definitive trial is BFAST. So this is a randomization based on BFIRST, where one of the cohorts, as I said, is the randomization to atezolizumab or platinum chemotherapy. And I think those results will probably come out in early 2001. Again, if that's positive, I think that will just increase people's confidence in using liquid biopsy, both for oncogene detection and perhaps for blood TMB as well. What trials do you think are important in this space? You're doing some, aren't you?
Yeah, so I think in addition to using liquid biopsy to guide initial treatment, I think the trials that you mentioned are going to be exceedingly important to guide delivery of care. But I also think that there are trials that are very interesting that are looking at using ctDNA and change in ctDNA over time as perhaps a predictive biomarker or as a surrogate for response in patients that are on immunotherapy. There are already clinical data out there that tell us that a reduction in ctDNA volume of the driver mutation correlates with not only response, but also at least progression-free survival in some of the reports that we have seen. And, you know, I think the same is true for immunotherapy. We conducted a trial where we collected serial blood samples in patients that were receiving either immunotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy and found that, you know, you could use a change in ctDNA over time to predict which patients are destined to respond and have superior outcomes. This work is currently under review. But there are other researchers who have sort of come to the same conclusion that this could be a very powerful way of monitoring disease burden in addition to radiographic monitoring. And in some cases, perhaps before radiographic monitoring to, you know, detect early response or early progression. So I do think that the future of liquid biopsy overall is very bright. And I think we'll have a lot of information over the next several years. I'll end off with one note. I think I'll say in the future, we'll also be perhaps, hopefully, using liquid biopsy approaches to select patients for adjuvant treatment selection. You know, with the imminent approval of osimertinib based on the early data that we saw at ASCO from the ADAURA trial, you know, we see that there's a DFS advantage for using osimertinib, but a few of us are skeptical. You know, should we be using this in all patients? Should we be giving indefinite TKI or 3 years TKI? I don't know how much TKI to all patients, but perhaps if we can use a tool such as liquid biopsies to detect which patients, maybe the highest risk patients, would be really a step in the right direction. And I do think that we are moving, we have the momentum, we have some of our tools and the tools are getting refined. And I think we'll be in a much better place 5 years from now.
I agree. And I think the example of the ARDURA trial is a good one. For example, those patients that had what we would define as minimal residual disease, by persistence of circulating tumor DNA a few weeks out from surgery, those are patients where we would predict they will all relapse. In other words, they have something that is still making those mutant DNA that gets shed into the plasma. So I agree with you 100%. And I guess my ending for this, I think this has been a great podcast. I always learn things when I do joint sessions with you. So I appreciate that.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.